What if I gave you a camcorder and it wasn't stabilized with a tripod and it was all shaky? What would the video that we got out look like? It would be blurry. Shaky in, blurry out. And how much detail could you see if it was a blurry video? Not as much as you want. And when it's blurry, you actually can't do something very specific with what you see, right? So if you think of it that way, then what we want to do is take a MindSight camera, which is basically your mind, and you're going to develop the ability to build a tripod. So literally, you're going to stabilize this part of your mental experience that allows you to look at the mind itself so that what you see is no longer blurry. Now, amazingly, this is the first step that allows you then to modify toward integration. If you can't see clearly, you can't modify with any specificity because you can't see anything. So it's kind of that simple. Now, you're going to see that we're going to build on the sense of openness to what is. This is one leg of the triangle. Objectivity, that is seeing that a thought or a feeling or even a sensation in your body is not the totality of who you are. It's like an object. You have an awareness. It's like the thing that you know about. It's not the experience of knowing. And the observation is the fact that there is a you that is observing. So you don't get lost in like an impulse or lost in a negative thought. You say, oh, that's just a negative thought. It comes and goes. When people are lost in their negative thoughts, it ruins their day. When someone has this skill, they go, oh, it's a negative thought. I won't take it so personally.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is March 4th, and what a great day it is. I'm very pleased to welcome back Kyle Davis to the show. But before we do that, a couple of notes. We open today with a clip of Dr. Daniel Siegel, and that is from a Google Health talk called Taking Time In. It actually comes up briefly in our discussion, and I thought I would mention it for those of you who might be interested in taking a look at meditation, specifically mindfulness meditation, through a more scientific lens. Daniel Siegel's work is great for that, and I will put a link to that video in the show notes. So Brett, pick a five-syllable word that best describes how today's show came to be. Serendipitous would be my choice. I recently got a really, really kind donation from a listener named Carla, and I want to say thank you to her on the show. But around the same time, I also received an email from a past guest, Kyle, and he asked for an update. Just so happens that Carla, this very kind donator, found Kyle's input on School Sucks and his teaching incredibly valuable, so I made this a top priority as a sign of gratitude to both of them, because Kyle added a lot of value to the show before. He adds a lot more value today. I'm really excited for you to hear this conversation, and I have been working on meditation for a while now, so I was happy to give him a little update on my progress and also to compile a list of questions. I also want to let you know that this weekend, really tomorrow through Sunday, is the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, and I will be there with bells on, hoping to do a bunch of interviews. I'm still in the process of setting them up. I've confirmed a few. I'm really excited about that. We'll hopefully have some old favorites returning. I do want to try and bring a couple of these people into our new studio. It's only about a mile away from the event, but I am also going there with a full mobile setup. I've got my Zoom, I've got some mics, I've got a camcorder, and I'm looking to give all of you a nice look at the Liberty Forum. If you're going to be there, I will be broadcasting live to an audience from 12 to 2 on Saturday. That's this Saturday. So I hope to see you there. You could sit down with us for a while if you want, and we can rap. I will bring the beats. So, yeah, looks like everything is just about perfect, right? Almost. I recorded this yesterday, and because I'm so excited about our new setup here, I asked Kyle if it would be okay if we could test live streaming, live video streaming of the interview. This process, from starting the computer to streaming live, involves a checklist with 22 steps on it. And wouldn't you know it, step 11, turn on compressor, must have slipped my mind. So in the audio, you are going to hear everything. If I drop a pin, you will hear it. Now, some people might not have noticed this at all if I hadn't, you know, opened my big mouth. but some of you hear everything. And this message is really for you. Because I forgot to turn on the compressor, if you are a headphones listener, I recommend turning the volume down to about 60%. I've worked on this for the last day or so, trying to make it the best it can possibly be. If you're listening without headphones, you should totally be fine. And sometimes I listen to, you know, brain music when I'm working. I have it going on in the background. So I've just put in a nice, soft, even music bed under our conversation, designed for attention and energy. And I hope that helps. Because some people are sticklers. Here's an example. I actually just went back to episode 300 when we first had Nick Hazelton on, because I wanted to include that discussion in the show notes for the last episode I put out with Nick. And there was a comment there. And it read, Brett, stop sucking on candy during your interviews. Now, first of all, folks, do I strike you as the kind of individual who sucks on candy? Absolutely not. But I was baffled. I was like, what would make the sound of me sucking on candy? So I'm just pointing this out because, number one, some people notice everything. Number two, we're making progress. Because today I can tell you exactly what went wrong. And someday we will have progressed to the point where maybe things just won't go wrong. And if they do, it's okay. I've got some strategies in place to weather those challenges. Or maybe more appropriately, leather those challenges. Ooh, what the hell is he talking about? Let's find out. Here we go. All right, so I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show, Kyle Davis. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Brett. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's nice and early enough on a Tuesday morning here. And first of all, I have to apologize. I know the last time we talked, I said I'd have you back in a month. I was off by 10 months. But here you are.
Yep, good to be back.
Part of what took me so long to get you back is I wanted to have new stuff to talk to you about. And I've been at it now for, you know, five solid months, but I haven't really advanced. I've just been doing the same thing and it's gotten comfortable. And now I'm ready to move on, I think. I think I'm ready to move on. And I want to see what's next. But I thought a good place for us to start would be just a review of the basics and what we covered in our first show.
Yeah, that's great.
So I had this misconception when we first talked that meditation was very much this passive kind of sleepy time relaxation process. And you described it as more of an active process. So let's talk about that a little bit first.
Yeah, that is sometimes a thought that people have, that it's kind of just hanging out and emptying the mind. Mm-hmm. But instead, it's more like working out the mind, so to speak. Training it, or like refining it or sharpening it. We were talking a little bit about a basic breathing meditation where we actively try to follow our breath, like the feeling of our breath as it enters and leaves our nose. And what we notice actually is that if we get too passive, we just start daydreaming, you know, or like we just start thinking about nothing, or we go to bed. And so if we have to actually be a little bit sharp and kind of on the ball, so to speak, as we train in that way.
Right, because we want to be able to not just, you know, put our minds to sleep. We want to actually, through this practice, be able to strengthen our minds, essentially, right?
Yeah, like I really like the idea of like restfully awake or restfully alert, and kind of finding, because sometimes when we're really alert, we feel agitated. And when we're restful, we're kind of dull. But if we can kind of unify those two qualities, then we'd find that to be so beneficial. And I think that's something that meditation teaches us to do, that kind of balance.
Absolutely. You know, people often talk about enlightenment as very sudden. It happens in a moment, you know, like that kind of thing. And we also discussed it being, you know, a practice, something that takes work and time, something that feels clumsy at first. I mean, when I really, you know, made a commitment to do it Monday through Friday, I would, you know, as much as I was trying to just focus on the air going in and out of my nostrils, I would always say, am I doing this right? You know, so it does feel clumsy at first, and the results are slow. So it does require a bit of perseverance and maybe even trying a few different things. I did have some questions about, a few postures or seating positions that I'd tried. Is music okay? You know, I live in close proximity to like a lot of people who are very unpredictable as far as the noise they're going to make. There's a taxi driver who likes to pull up in front of the building and honk his horn.
Yes.
Sometimes, and I can't predict it. Next time he does it, I'll go out and ask for his schedule. But you know, how do we want to focus on what's inside, I think, but it's easy to get distracted worrying about posture, worrying about other types of distractions. And of course, am I really doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Because the results, you know, do come very slowly. And I will say, you know, they have come. I have gotten positive benefits from doing this. But let's talk a little bit about the practice.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's such a rich question to think about too. Like, how do we take up the practice in a way that has a long-term vision that still is focused on like being technically correct, but not being technically obsessive? sort of grasping too tightly at the perfect conditions, which will never happen, you know.
Yeah.
So kind of where does that balance lie? I heard a nice quote lately. My friend's son started Taekwondo.
Yeah.
And the sort of master or whatever there said, every black belt starts off as a white belt.
Like that. That is true. Yep.
Yeah, and it's just like it's sort of simple, but I think it's a nice way to relate to ourselves, like as a beginner. And then it's totally, it can be a little bit relaxed. Like, this is a long-term practice. And then if, you know, results come or they don't come, then we just still recognize like we're a beginner. And that there's sort of this peace or like humility in that space, as opposed to I need to be getting this right by now, or I need to be the best meditator by now.
Yeah,
which like creates all this sort of, you know, angst or just pride and confusion.
Sure. So just some specifics related to that. Like, how do you feel about music? I've actually been using this program. It's not actually music. I use this program called Binaural Beats, which basically plays these sound frequencies that are loud enough to drown out, you know, a pot clanking or a blender running or a horn honking, but it's not really distracting. It's like it's very consistent, and it's just an app that people can download for Android, and I'm sure there's an iPhone equivalent that plays these frequencies that are designed to do different things to put the brain in different states. Do you think that is maybe unnatural?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the more distracting the music or whatever would get, the more it would actually would become a hindrance at some point.
Sure.
But having it function as white noise, maybe that's a space where it could be really useful if it's drowning out the other distractions of our world, like the taxi cab driver, or like I live next to a carpentry shop, so they're always like, you know, grinding metal and, you know, cutting wood with a buzzsaw and, you know, throwing things around. And, you know, it is nice to have some kind of white noise covering it at times.
Yeah.
But then there's also a space where we can develop our concentration in a way that we can stay concentrated even amidst that stuff, which is very powerful for like our daily life. You know, like for someone, let's say, working in an office, trying to keep a peaceful mind and everyone's chattering all the time.
Yeah.
To be able to cut through that and not ascertain it or not get drawn in would be very useful.
Yeah, it seems like through practice, you could discipline the mind. We've been using the phrase discipline minds in kind of a negative way on my show recently for
Oh, really?
People who are trained and conditioned by others, but we could kind of discipline our own minds to move through those distractions. We just did this series on Stoicism, and I wanted to talk about, you know, what you knew about that philosophy, because it relates to Buddhism quite a bit. But if we're not serene, if we're not accepting, we tend to speak in a lot of demand-oriented language. You know, I must concentrate. I must have peace. You know, right. That kind of thing. So when it's disrupted, it is incredibly unsettling and frustrating. But I think with more practice, I have actually found that if somebody suddenly honks a horn, I can say, yes, that is the kind of thing that is annoying, but I don't have to be annoyed by it. I don't have to be disrupted by it. I don't have to run out on my deck and start packing snowballs to throw at the taxi.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, I'm not perfect yet by any stretch of the imagination, but at least there's that slowing down. There's a bigger space between a stimulus like that and, you know, a poorly planned or poorly thought out response.
Yeah, I think that's what we start to find when we meditate. Like, there's a little bit of a space there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you guys talk a lot about interactions between maybe an authority figure and a subordinate, maybe like a parent and a child, or a boss and government authority and a citizen. And we think, like, a lot of times when those things go awry, it's because we don't have that, like, the authority figure doesn't have that space in their mind, and it makes them lash out, you know.
Yeah.
But since they're an authority, they can kind of justify the lashing out, so to speak.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm the one in charge, so I get to say this. But in reality, it's just because they're upset and they're anxious and they don't really know what to do with it. So they blame the person or the taxi cab driver or the child.
Right. But so in their shifting focus away from the things that they can actually control. Right? Because it's like this abdication of responsibility, too. And it's, you know, I'm not blaming anyone who does that. It's certainly, I think, a big part of a lot of the training we get in school and college and even in work that, you know, we're kind of small and the world is kind of big and it throws stuff at us, and doesn't that suck? So taking, you know, understanding that things just are, what's the Buddhist saying? Things are neither good or bad. It's thinking that makes them so.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I think it's Buddhist. It's been attributed to Buddhism, as far as I know.
It totally makes sense in the fact that we, like, the snow that's going on everywhere.
Yeah.
Everyone is experiencing it in different ways. You know, kids are so delighted. You know,
oh,
I would imagine.
Yeah.
They're like, they view the snow. It starts coming down and they get filled with joy and, like, this exuberant feeling. And then most adults see the snow start to come down and they think, oh no, like, again, you know, I've had enough, you know. And it's just snow. It's just water that's condensed in some way and it's coming from the sky.
Yeah,
there's no need for it to be a problem necessarily, but it's just the way that we relate to it in the end of the day.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. Like, living in a city where when it snows, there's parking bans and we have to find places to put our cars.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, the parking garage is 2 miles away. I didn't even think about what it is like. Like, what if I was 14 right now and I had school tomorrow and it's, you know, coming down a couple inches an hour? I would be psyched.
Yeah, it's a great practice. Like, whenever we identify something going on where there's two different perceptions of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this, like, meme going out, right, about the dress.
Yes.
And but it shows this fascinating thing about the mind. Whenever we notice this, there's one version, there's another version. Both people have an accurate, like, they're not crazy. They have some accurate say in the matter. All of a sudden, we see, whoa, there's possibility, actually. There's some flexibility in the way that I relate to this. And I think that's some of the space that is made when we meditate, because we start to find, like, we start to become more inwardly involved. And so we start to see, how are my perceptions influencing this similarly experienced event, like the dress?
Mm-hmm.
Is it gold and white or blue and black? Or is the snow terrible or is it all right? Is it not a big deal?
Yeah, trying to see through somebody else's eyes, and then it kind of exposes our own biases and what we bring to it, and then that it separates those things and we can actually isolate them and look at them. I really like that. That's a great insight. So we got into all that through the question, is music okay? And that's great,
right?
That was a great expansion of that question. The other thing that I realized is you can't do this lying down, I've decided. You need to be seated and alert. I struggled a little bit with, you know, I looked for recommended postures, and the one that I found was the half lotus. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that. I don't know exactly how I would describe it.
I could describe it.
Like, sure.
What you do is it's like sitting in a cross-legged position, but then you put your one foot up on your thigh.
Yeah.
And that's the position you're speaking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm about as flexible as the Tin Man from the Wizard of Oz. Right. So it was like it was a little tricky to get that position right. But then I found this thing called the Full Lotus. That's like tucking both your legs up, right? So both your feet are, while you're sitting what we usually call Indian style, cross-legged, both your feet are facing the ceiling, the bottoms of your feet.
Yeah,
that's amazing to me. That's pretty advanced. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's a familiarity thing. I think in the end of the day, because I know when I got interested in meditation, I thought like the only way I could ever be a good meditator is if I was doing that, which is completely false, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sort of, you know, creating this idea in mind, and so I just would do it for like, when I'd sit to meditate, I'd do it for like 2 minutes, and then I'd shift to the normal cross-legged stance, you know, and then the next time I do it for maybe 2 minutes and 30 seconds. And eventually through developing flexibility, it becomes a little bit more familiar and comfortable.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like if something is bothering us when we're meditating, especially physically, it just needs to be disregarded probably for the time being, because we can get so obsessed or focused on the pain in our legs or the pain in our back or this position feels weird that we're not even doing anything with our mind.
Yeah. Like,
you know, we just feel annoyed afterwards.
No, so what I realized was I needed to just find what would work to try to prevent, not that I wanted to fight it while I was actually meditating, but to prevent the doubts from creeping in about what I was doing. So I would settle, you know, just sitting cross-legged. Sometimes I would sit in a chair because I find that helps me, you know, keep my back extra straight.
Yeah.
And I wanted to enter that into the conversation here because I think if people start, you know, researching this stuff on their own and they see somebody sitting that way and they say, oh, okay, well, that's how you start. There are options, at least. Mm-hmm. For what you can do. So sometimes I just, you know, sit on the edge of the bed or sit in a chair and just try to keep my body, I think you said before, like an antenna.
Yeah, one thing too I think I forgot to say is that a helpful adjustment for anyone who's meditating, either in a chair or on the ground, is to have something where it helps their pelvis tilt a little bit forward or downward. This just makes everything a little bit more comfortable on the spine. We're not like holding our back up as much. It's supporting itself. So this is a helpful thing to kind of play around with. Right? So if you're in a chair, sometimes I'll put like a pillow or something just at like the edge of my butt, you know, like just helping my body tilt a little bit forward.
Oh, so behind you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, like, so it's not completely under me, like a full seat, but it's just helping me tilt a little bit. And we'll find like if our pelvis can tilt downwards a little bit, it's a lot more comfortable. It's easier to stay sitting straight too.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only other technical question for beginners was length. And when we talked about this before, because this was such an open-ended practice, it was hard to give specific answers. So the value I thought we could add in this show is because I've tried things, because I've done some things now. You know, I could tell you I started 5 minutes. Over time, I worked my way up to 7 or 8. And I found that 5 minutes is a very manageable amount of time to start with. And I'm working my way up now to 10. But with that extra time, I also wanted to advance in the practice a little bit, which is another thing that I wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, it's nice that you were able to test that out too and see that it's not a problem to start with a manageable chunk. You know, like you said, you know, months of doing it every day. But if you started off with like an hour, it might have been like 2 days and then been like, screw this is terrible.
Exactly.
Like, I need to go back to my life, man. I don't have time for this. But like, we could so fit in 5 minutes, you know, and and just and gain a little skill, you know, each time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I started, you know, slowly with your recommendation of focusing on breathing, the sensation of breath going in and out through the nose. And this is called, I will try to pronounce it, and then you can correct me, Anapanasati?
That might be one of the terms. There's so many versions and languages and so on that
sure.
are used, but I just call it breathing meditation.
Okay.
It's just a little simpler for me, but yeah.
Okay. So that was, I think, really good for a few months to get familiar with the practice, to feel comfortable with the practice, and to just start seeing some results of that quiet time, that exercise. And, you know, I found that I was more calm. I found that I was able to focus for longer periods of time, that I felt like my mind was working better. I went through a period a little bit before the last time we spoke where I really just felt dull, and it was, you know, it was kind of scary. I feel this practice, and it could be a couple of different things that I've done, but this practice is definitely partially responsible for sharpening me up a little bit. You know, the nature of my work is shifting very quickly sometimes between a number of things and 20 windows open in an internet browser and 500 notes in my organizer and emails coming in. And I really have felt like that has been more manageable in the last 3 or 4 months. You know, we also did this series on Stoicism that I already mentioned, and keeping some of that philosophy in mind has been helpful as well. But I can tell, long story short, that meditation has made a very positive difference so far.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, it's nice to see those results too. Like, we don't want to grasp too strongly at them, but to see the benefits is encouraging.
Yeah,
because it makes us interested. Well, what else is out there, or what else can I do with these strategies?
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of fits in with one of the missions of this show. I'm learning along with the people listening, hopefully. So it was very hard to find someone who was like going through the process of learning meditation. Most of the people who write about it are pretty advanced.
Right.
So it's like there's this here to there problem that I was experiencing when I studied it, you know, long before we talked the first time. So, you know, I hope it's helpful to people to say, I'm 3-4 months in at this point. This is what I've done. There have been positive results. I know one of my listeners, you mentioned to me, actually went and did some classes with you and had very positive results, and that's great to hear. So, yeah, I hope that this show will inspire more people to get started. But for those who maybe already have started or who would want to advance more quickly, I wanted to talk a little bit more about beginning mindfulness meditation. First of all, what is that? How is it practiced? And ultimately, maybe we could talk about some of the benefits of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's a buzzword these mm-hmm. days, mm-hmm. Especially in my world. And it means different things to different people. But one thing I could do is just convey like a couple strategies we use.
Yeah.
In trying to be mindful throughout our day. Basically, we say like, mindfulness means like remembering, and our mind is sort of full of a certain idea, and it's specifically relevant in our daily life when we're busy,
mm-hmm.
you know, because so we have this sort of formal meditation time, which is precious and nice, but how much of our day can we really be spending, you know, on a cushion or in silence? You know, for most of us, we're busy, you know, we're interacting with people, we're going to tough situations, we're getting stuck in traffic, and we want a strategy for those times. You know, we need a meditative way of being in those circumstances.
Yeah.
And so there's certain things that we can remember or think about while being amidst our life in order to actually extract more meaning from them, as opposed to have challenging situations like deplete our energy. And instead, they could actually challenging situations or just life in general can increase our insight or understanding.
Yeah. a lot of people, and certainly been true for me in the past, we want to escape those situations, or I can think of many situations like that that I wanted to escape. I was talking to a young man just like, well, it was a while ago, maybe about a month, about Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, how he was often misunderstood as being the philosopher of people suck, you know, they're hopeless. But I think a lot of his writing reflects this frustration in that people don't realize their potential because they're looking for safety and mediocrity, and they want to escape challenge. They don't want the lessons of challenge. They don't want the growth process of challenge. There was this, I forget his name. I've mentioned him like 50 times on the show, and probably even in the last show you were on, Taking Time In, Daniel Siegel. And he talks about, you know, the mind being on a kind of tripod that keeps it stable, like a camera sits on a tripod to capture reality in a beautiful and accurate way, you know? And if you don't have that, if you're handheld, then that's not going to work. Right. So the tripod legs could be different things. You know, in meditation or even Buddhism, things like impermanence, the recognition of impermanence, the recognition that life is going to at times be unsatisfactory, the acceptance of that, and what's sometimes described as non-self. We could get into that along the way here, but having that tripod or having just that stability, whatever metaphor you want to use, I think makes us more willing to embrace the discomfort, the uncertainty, the frustration.
Yeah, that's a really nice way to say it. Like just having that tenets or those ways of looking at thing or ways of understanding can give us this grounding, you know, in life. You know, it's like having a really good car with good four wheels on it, you know, and it helps us navigate through icy roads and bumps and potholes and all that sort of thing. But if they're not really sturdy or strong, then we're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah,
it's going to be hard to get anywhere. I could mention a few really simple strategies.
Sure, like, yeah, that'd be great.
Strategies.
Yeah.
Yeah, so one that's kind of nice, when we're experiencing bad feelings, especially, like maybe we're really frustrated or we're feeling like hateful or really like strongly attached to something that we can't let go of or whatever it is, and we start to feel pain inside, we can think countless other people feel this also. And it's a simple thing to do, but it's kind of like getting manure dumped on your doorstep growing things out of it. You know, what we do is we grow the mind of compassion, you know, which is like this wish for other people to not be suffering or experiencing that. So like we take our experience as a point, like maybe we got broken up with from our significant other and we're really upset. And we think like, wow, this is what other people are talking about when they're writing, you know, love songs about heartbreak, or this is what my friend was going through when he was so upset or she was so upset. And then all of a sudden we get this feeling like, I know what this is like. This is what they're going through. And then we can develop this powerful mind, which is like, I want them to be free of that. I want them to be free of that pain or that uncomfortable feeling. And so we essentially use our point as this like in, or this doorway in to understanding what others are going through. And we get this precious understanding out of it.
Yeah.
This sort of selfless mind.
Compassion.
Yeah, compassion.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's a nice one because we're just always running into problems. You know? Another one that's really nice is if we're dealing with a challenging person, especially, or we're in a challenging situation, we can think this person or this situation is like a teacher for me. Mm-hmm. They're teaching me patience, especially, and because the only way we can grow patience, like a sort of heartfelt acceptance, not a gritting your teeth type thing, but a real acceptance of what's going on, is to be dealing with challenging situations. You know, that's the only way to grow that muscle. And so we can think when we're in them, like we're stuck in traffic or we're, you know, waiting on a long line at, you know, the doctors or something, or we're dealing with a person who's just always, you know, pointing out our faults or whatever. We just think, like they're teaching me in reality. Like they're letting me grow. And then we use it as an opportunity to grow understanding or attitude instead of it being, this just sucks, you know, which is just,
yeah,
we just feel so trapped in that state.
I really like that one. You know, the last time you were on, I actually used it to open the show. You talked about, hey, you know, instead of trying to cover the world in leather, how about shoes? You know, I really like that. I think that says so much about, you know, not, I worry sometimes about acceptance without assertiveness, right? And this is kind of like why the whole New Age movement and the whole self-esteem movement that happened decades past, it got a lot of criticism because it was seen as like giving up. You know,
right,
but in what you're saying, it's both. It's, you know, you recognize, it's not giving up. It's recognizing that acceptance is important. You cannot cover the whole world in leather, but you're also, you know, asserting and taking responsibility by putting these shoes on. So, you know, your responsibility for your feet, and you want to assert yourself by being able to walk along on this uncomfortable surface. And, you know, it's interesting too, because I really over the course of the last 5 years have tried to take more control over my life. And that's kind of a vague statement, you know, like I used to get in my car and drive to work. I used to commute like 600 miles a week and in Boston, by the way, like area, all four seasons.
I'm going to get nightmares.
Yeah. So it became very important to me, like around the time I started the show, that I wanted, you know, more freedom from these externals. As I achieved it over the years, I actually found myself having less patience and less frustration tolerance for the externals. Like my work day, I would be totally in control. I would work from home. I would be my own boss. It was great. But then I would go to the drugstore, and I would find that there was a line like 15 people long. And for some reason, this was just intolerable, you know? So I had tried to, I think, leather the earth more than just the shoes. So I had leathered my area, you know? And then I had to step off. I had to step into places that I haven't leathered yet. And it was incredibly frustrating. So I realized, like, oh, I'm doing this backwards. Like, yes, of course, I do want personal and professional freedom where I can have it, but I also need to have tools or protections in place for the stuff that's outside of that.
Yeah, that's such a nice insight to think about. Like, if we make it too easy on ourselves, while it's nice at first, and we do need easy enough, right? Like, we can't be in a war-torn area. I mean, we can, but it's a lot harder to find some inner peace in a war-torn area. You know, so we do want something that's pretty good, but if we don't have these regular challenges once in a while, that muscle can atrophy.
Yeah,
our sort of patience muscle. And I like it's such an interesting point that you raised about the assertiveness point, because I think too that one of the misconceptions about it's like a certain understanding of acceptance is that it's either like it's a repression. That's one of the understandings that I think where it goes wrong, because it's totally not about hiding our feelings or burying our feelings or being a doormat.
Right.
But it's instead like accepting what's going on, and then from that place of peace actually being able to fix it way better. And like, I don't know if you've ever been like, I'm sure you've been in many debates, and you know, like when the feeling of like anger starts to arise,
yeah,
it's a lot harder to be really logical and like clear and effective.
Yeah.
I become completely pretty much useless in the discussion at that point. And so it's actually my anger that makes me not assertive. I become ineffective. But if I can keep this state of acceptance of what's going on, even if someone's presenting an idea that I find reprehensible,
yeah,
then I can have this clarity still. And of course, it's especially important in things that where there's nothing we can do about it. Like, let's say we get a cold, and if we just have to wait, or like the stomach flu, and we just have to wait it through. You know, we've taken the medicine we can do. There's no point to fight it at that point. Like, if we just, we're way better off accepting it. Of course, we take the measures to fix it or heal it. But once we've done everything we can do, then we settle into it.
Do you still find, you know, you've studied meditation for a long time. I know you practice Buddhism, right? Is that a fair characterization? Do you still find yourself in certain situations, like let's talk about some of those arguments or disagreements that might come up? Like, you know, I know a lot about your philosophy. You were at Liberty Forum last year. Do you engage with people? Do you try to bring this practice into, you know, that presentation? Yeah, and do you, and more importantly, do you, you know, have slip-ups? Things don't go so well. You do lose your patience?
Yeah, definitely. But what I've noticed, though, is that through time, those situations, they start to lessen. Mm-hmm. You know, and just seeing that trend is really encouraging. Like, when I'm in this situation, I don't get as bothered or frustrated. Or when someone says something nasty to me, I don't take it necessarily personally. I maybe still address it and try to correct them or say, hey, that's not okay. But I don't do it with this sort of hateful, spiteful mind.
Yeah.
And so just seeing those developments are great. Of course, still slip up and, especially with maybe certain sensitive subjects or with certain people that are, you know, can rub me the wrong way, of course. But what's encouraging is just seeing it happen a little bit less, you know, and just being a little bit more tolerant for people in general.
Yeah, you know, I really had convinced myself for a long time that calmness came from being right, you know, so since I'm right, I can relax. And I can just watch this other person that I'm arguing with have their anxiety attack, but look at me. But that was such a negative attitude as far as like understanding, compassion, fairness, for whatever that word is worth, in a discussion like that, because it's just like I'm having this air of superiority and I'm teaching this other person. And then you bring whatever that feeling is back home with you or away from that discussion. And, you know, I can really, this really comes through and just like looking at the way people talk online, there's this like frustration and intolerance for just the world, you know,
right.
for pop culture, for sports, for politics. And I realized for my own serenity, for my own stress level, I needed to find a way to mitigate all of that. Because before engaging without a methodology for communicating compassionately, for communicating peacefully, it was a mess in the actual situation. The other person would feel bad if it happened at a party. People at the party would feel uncomfortable if it happened at a family dinner. The other people at the family dinner would feel uncomfortable. That person would take negative feelings away from the interaction. I would take negative feelings away from the interaction. And then I would just like stew in them. For days sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So bringing, you know, different shoes, if you will, to that interaction and really a different mindset has been very helpful. It took a long time to learn how to do that. And I don't do it that much anymore. And I don't want to think of it as avoidance, but it's also like the whole serenity thing. What can I control? What can't I control? And let's operate within the realm of able to control. And a lot of those discussions are outside of that realm. Mm-hmm. Actually, that being said, how familiar are you with the philosophy of Stoicism?
Just, you know, vaguely familiar. I know about Zeno a bit because mm-hmm. I found some of his thought experiments really intriguing and really in line with some Buddhist philosophy. Yeah, I'd be happy to hear a little bit or like anything that particularly stood out.
Sure, yeah.
Your guys' investigation.
We did, I think, a four-part series with a couple of follow-up episodes, too. And I pulled up a note here called The 10 Themes of Stoicism that I thought I could share with you. We found a lot of connections to Buddhism, so that's why I brought it up. The first theme, which is what actually triggered the question in my mind, recognize what is under your control and what isn't under your control. And don't worry about what isn't under your control. Now, there's more to that, right? Like worrying, helpless worrying is one kind of worrying, but actionable, like problem solving and thinking about something is different than just actionless worrying. 2, conform your will to the divine order of the universe. We'll shoot through these and you can comment where you like. We expanded these 10 into like an hour and a half of discussion. The gentleman who did the series with me. The third one, understand your emotions, but don't repress or assent to all emotions. You know, stopping and thinking about and recognizing like what the emotions are. And, you know, through practice, trying to become more of a master of your own mind. I might skip just a few of these just to relate it better to Buddhism. 5, understand that events are not problematic. Rather, it's your thinking that makes them so. Adjust your beliefs and expectations to fit reality. 6, live with compassion and respect for human rights. 7, cultivate right thinking through daily activities like meditation, contemplation, reflecting, and journaling. Stoics talk about this as a kind of immunization, right? Those are the shoes, the leather shoes in the uncomfortable world. 8, understand that the external world is determined, but you have inner freedom to choose your attitudes towards these determined things, which is really just a clarification of that first theme, control versus out of control. 9, calmness, humility, discipline, and indifference to pleasure and pain. Because of their worldview and training, Stoics are calm in the face of adversity, which we've also discussed. And that's it. I mean, those are the ones that I think are most relating to Buddhism.
Yeah, there's so many similarities in there. It sounds like the 10 points of Buddhism.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Those are so practical too. That's why I like them. Like, you can take a lot of those kind of nuggets of wisdom and see how could I use this like right now in my day with my kids or at hanging out with my friends. And like for example, the one about expectations I really like, because it's such a great way to engage with our life. If we just see, okay, what's going on? Mm-hmm. This is especially if we're agitated, that's the best. Or like we're feeling like kind of unhappy about something. We see, okay, what's going on? Is there an expectation present that I'm grasping on strongly to? So maybe it's with a significant other and they're maybe they're grumpy one day and we're starting to get really upset that they're grumpy. And we're like, okay, well, what expectation do I have here? And what we might find through investigation, we might see, I have this expectation that they should just always be pleasant. But I don't have that expectation about myself. You know, I've just placed that on them. And if I didn't have it, what would it feel like?
Yeah.
You know, I might be okay. I might just see them as a normal human being who's just a little grumpy. You know, it's not a big deal. But when I'm comparing them versus the should-be person, who they should be, all of a sudden it turns into this unpleasant, nasty situation where we feel this is a problem. Yeah. You need to be nicer to me. Or the weather needs to be better. I expected it to be nice today. Or even just like, I expected this movie to be really good. All my friends told me how good it was going to be. And now it's just pretty good. And all of a sudden we see our expectation completely ruining our experience.
Yeah, yeah.
We built up the should-be reality that we're comparing it to.
I think that should-be reality, I mean, again, speaking from my own experience, is really from just having so much internal storm and stress that, you know, it's, and when you have to deal with other people and other situations and you're like, look, man, you know, one more thing and I'm just going to dive out the window, you know?
Yeah.
So I need everybody else because I have this internal chaos. I really just need everybody else to do exactly what I would expect them to do, what creates the most external peace for me, considering that I'm dealing with this internally chaotic world.
So. Yeah, it makes sense. Like, if our shoes aren't really good, you know, we're walking around barefoot, we want the world to be, you know, we don't want there to be any broken glass and all that. But we create extra problems by having a strong desire for things to be in a way that they're not going to be, you know, or like an unrealistic expectation that things are just going to work out all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so we make it, not only did it not work out, but now we're extra upset because we really, really wanted it or thought it should work out.
Right.
So it's kind of like compounded our issue or upset feeling.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So do you use the word vipassana in your practice?
Right, right. Yeah, I think some people sometimes call it like vipassana.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, vipassana.
I assume that's the same word that you're talking about.
Yeah.
We don't use it as often, but I noticed those three kind of hallmarks of reality that you pointed out.
Yeah.
The impermanence, and that life has unsatisfactory characteristics, and that no self concept. Were you relating those three to that term?
I was relating those three to that term, and I mentioned the first two because I think they related to what we were discussing earlier. But I wanted to talk about this non-self idea. I could imagine people in the audience kind of backing away from that a little bit. But what is that? What does that mean to you? What is that all about?
Yeah, it's a deep question because, like, you know, when people say what was the Buddha's like real deal at the end of the day? Like, what was he actually unique for?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are Buddhists really about? I think a lot of them would say, like, that this concept of no self is the sort of heart of the matter, and that everything else is actually supporting or helping us get to this understanding about reality. And essentially, there's tons to it, of course, so I'll try to just keep it simple. Essentially, it's saying that the self that we normally relate to isn't there, but it appears to our mind. We conceive it, but it's more like a hallucination. And we might think, why does that matter? Or why would understanding that really even help us? But one thing we can start to see is that in situations, like when we're experiencing a difficulty, we start to see that it's usually because, you know, we have this strong wish for things to go how we want them to go. But then amidst that strong wish, there's a strong sense of I or self.
Mm-hmm.
And we grasp really strongly at that because, yeah, we believe it's there, essentially. And as a result of that, we want the best for our I. We want the best things. And so we get attached or we cling on to those things. And we want to avoid anything we deem as bad. So we feel aversion or anger towards anything we deem not good for ourselves. But it all stems towards defending or protecting this sense of I because we believe it in the first place.
So it relates to what we were just talking about, you know, about not wanting to the person ready to dive out the window a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Where it maybe if I use the term like false self, because of the ways that we're raised, certainly in this country, because of the schooling experience that we have, and, you know, even it continues into this cultural conformity of adulthood, we're told a lot about who we are. And we don't get much, especially in like our most formative years, we don't have a lot of time or a lot of freedom to discover that for ourselves. And I think that also helps create that internal chaos, obviously, because there's not a lot of empowerment there. So we're always kind of fighting, you know, all of the things that are happening externally. Is that fair? Is that related to the Buddhist concept?
I think so, yeah. It's like what happens is that we grasp really strongly at this sort of sense of self, mm-hmm. but it usually has all these limited connotations to it. Like,
yeah.
I'm valuable because I'm attractive.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
I'm valuable because I'm smart. Or I'm valuable because people like me. And mm-hmm. Or I'm worthless. Or I am a loser. Or I'm always depressed. But it comes from the strong sense of I in the first place. And usually what we find is the more we focus on just ourself in those situations, it just gets stronger and stronger.
Sure.
So it's a combination of like thinking that we're valuable just based on these uncontrolled things, like that we're attractive or we're smart, or actually being going to the other extreme of thinking we are worthless or we're stupid or, you know, we're a loser or all these various adjectives people give to themselves. So then at the end of the day, they're stuck with all these limited selves that they hate, you know? Mm-hmm. People don't like themselves in this world right now. There's so many people that want to end their life, for example, because they can't stand their self.
Yeah, yeah.
They want it to end, you know, they think it's terrible or whatever.
You know, it makes me think of this question, too. We talk a lot about the philosophy of objectivism on the show, really relating to the practice of living in the real world. And I know that sounds kind of like a harsh term, but how would you say we could, this might be a difficult question. It's a good one to end on. Balance that recognition that you just mentioned about the self with the fact that we are surrounded by people who are putting value on us for certain things. Valuable because of looks or intelligence or a set of skills. And we want to, in some ways, progress successfully through that world, right? Because I think about it, like a lot of people who listen to the show, maybe they're high school students, maybe they're college students, maybe they're young professionals. They live in a world, I think, that's very difficult for them to just snap their fingers and escape, right? There are all these external valuations coming their way. And you do want to, obviously, like, you know, build a resume. And you do have to consider that sometimes those external appraisals of your value are, even if they're not the real deal, you have to, like, consider them to progress in certain ways in life. Maybe toward financial freedom or toward, you know, professional satisfaction. What do you think of that?
Right. So you're kind of saying like there are these certain appraisal methodologies in our world that help us, quote unquote, get ahead or help us reach these certain goals we have. And so how do we reconcile that fact,
sure,
like getting good grades or, you know, getting a good job or whatever?
Yeah.
And the fact that necessarily that doesn't make us a valuable person or worthwhile person if that goes well.
Absolutely.
Or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think it comes with like how we develop our own confidence, because there's nothing inherently wrong about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think what happens is that when we don't have a lot of confidence in ourselves, then we start to think that that's what makes us matter, or that's what makes us really happy at the end of the day, are those approvals or that appreciation from others or the good job that we have or the nice house or the attractive spouse. And I think the reason we make that assumption is simply because we're not really finding it inside, you know, like mm-hmm. we're not finding it from our states of mind that are leading to a more serene inner atmosphere or more like selfless or compassionate inner atmosphere where like we're at peace with ourselves. And so we feel like a hole or a void. Mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. we try to find it or fill it with all this sort of stuff like appreciation or reputation or fame or whatever.
Yeah.
And when we're doing it in that way, that whole rat race is so painful. But if we're already cool with ourselves, you know, if we can already be accepting within ourselves, like we found that on the inside, we can find real happiness. Like we don't actually need stuff to do that.
Yeah.
We can just find it within our mind. Then we'll do the rest as like a means to an end,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the sole source of our life. And we know even if it goes wrong, it doesn't mean that we're worthless or that we can't find a sense of fulfillment or anything like that.
Yeah, really, really well put. I mean, I just remember there were some times in my life where I felt like I really need to, maybe even it was a suggestion, like you really need to take some time for yourself, mm-hmm. you know? And I would say, yeah, sure, but I also need to keep doing all these things. It was like in our first conversation, it was you said something like, yeah, I should meditate, but I don't have time for meditation today because I got all these other things that I got to do, right? So you're kind of putting maybe what's a more important thing last. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to prioritize that thing that doesn't have the short-term fix kind of results, you know?
Right.
Like you say, well, I could check five things off my checklist in the 15 minutes that it would take me to do this thing that will actually help me in the long run. So a lot of people, when they look at that, what appears to be a trade-off between time for myself and continuing with maybe the rat race in many cases, they feel like they have to pick the rat race, and it's an either or choice. And I found that it's not. So I thought that that was an important a thing to make clear, you know, at the end of the show.
Yeah, that's such a helpful way to end too. And just thinking like, that's like one of the unique things about the Buddha actually, is that he didn't just go live in a cave after he like worked on himself. He like went back into the world and he helped people, and he was a teacher, you know, he was with people, and he rejected that idea that you need to just be alone and separate. But in fact, you can be in the world and be amidst people and be living our life, but just also be spending time, you know, refining our mind and like using the mindfulness strategies that we talked about, or just spending time to improve it in meditation. And then there's no contradiction actually, in that in fact, we could even use the rat race, so to speak, as a way to improve ourselves.
Yeah.
It gives us a lot of manure to grow crops with.
That is true. It certainly does. Well said. So, Kyle, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate the insights you provided today. And I hope you'll just share your site with us one more time, where people can check out your work.
In Providence, we're meditationinrhodeisland.org. And in Massachusetts, like in the Boston Meditation Center and so on, we're at meditationinmass.org.
So I will make a commitment to do this more regularly. I realize we have a lot that we can talk about. I'm going to keep, you know, working on my meditation practice, and I'd like to update you again a few months from now, if you'd be open to that.
Yeah, I would love to. I really enjoyed being here and discussing these various topics.
Excellent. All right. Well, have a great day, great week, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks, Brett. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.